Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Nipples, curls, hot shoes, spectacles, nipples, curls, let's make this a beautiful.
Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where we talk about an episode of The Muppet Show, 45 years after its original New York City air date. This is the Alice Cooper episode, which was the seventh production episode from season three. It was recorded between March 28th and March 30th of 1978, which is in that sweet spot when it could have been added to the extra-long UK season two,
okay,
where they tied in a bunch of previous episodes that were recorded, because this is literally being made during the production end of the previous season. And as
right.
you remember, they added basically the first few episodes of the third season onto that. However, this didn't air in the UK until November 24th of 1978. It aired in New York City on October 30th of 1978.
Ben, you're more of... You've been to England.
I have.
You've spent time there.
Yeah.
Is Halloween around late November there?
Halloween being adopted in the UK at all as trick-or-treating and costumes is a fairly recent development, and its encroachment over the last, I'm making this number up, 20 years is one of those things that people are like, the creeping Americanism coming in. Like, we think of it as something that we adopted from the UK, specifically Celtic traditions.
Mm-hmm.
But no, the UK is like, no, we don't do that. What's wrong with you? Until recently, when they started to. I think its proximity to Bonfire Night on November 5th may have dulled it somewhat, that they already had their own, right around that time,
mm-hmm.
Bonfires and Burning Things festival, and so dressing up in costume just seemed weird. But do you know when else this might have aired? It, which is another way of saying, is there or is there not a TV Guide listing for this episode?
As my usual answer, I'm gonna say yes.
Correct. You get an extra half point.
Yes!
This aired on November 2nd, 1978 in St. Louis.
Oh.
And because of that, we have the TV Guide entry for the episode, which is as follows. Rock performer Alice Cooper joins the Muppets in a ghoulish rendition of Welcome to My Nightmare. Other numbers include You and Me and School's Out.
Interesting.
We've talked before about how we feel like in this time, particularly with musicians, them performing their hits or other numbers was one of the attractive things to list in the guide.
Yep.
Because of a lack of reruns, because of the inability to decide when you would hear certain songs on the radio, that basically being able to tell somebody, you'll be able to see a musician that you like perform something within this half an hour next week, was quite actually a selling point.
I'm going to ask you a question that you might not be able to answer,
yeah,
because it might be part of trivia.
Mm.
I'm intrigued by the fact that they left out Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Mm.
Is You and Me an Alice Cooper song?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yep, those three songs are all Alice Cooper songs. The three songs that Cooper performs are all Cooper numbers.
Okay.
And of those three, while Welcome to My Nightmare is from his most recent album in 75, that only got to the number 45 position in the Billboard Top 100. I'm sorry, the Billboard Hot 100. But School's Out, which is their big finale number,
mm-hmm.
reached number one in the UK for 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So it makes sense in terms of the order in which they choose to do his three numbers in the episode. They start with the new one, they go to the ballad, and they close with the banger.
Yeah.
It is legitimate perfect programming.
So that makes sense why they listed all three, so you'd know. But you'd think you'd mention Somewhere Over the Rainbow in there somewhere.
But there's over nothing the rainbow in this description that's about the Muppets.
Right.
It's just about Cooper and what he does. And since Over the Rainbow is a song that he's not involved in.
Mm-hmm. It's just that my perception is that he has fans and he has haters.
Mm.
And so that might be a thing that you might want to list to be like, oh, well, I'm not going to watch that Alice Cooper devil guy. But if you're like, oh, but they are going to sing that song from that movie I like.
Go on, what's that movie?
The Wiz.
Congratulations.
Erd of Oz. Sorry. I had to take a big breath.
Thanks. I needed to wait for it. You didn't tell me. But since you mention the quiz, let us get to some trivia questions about Alice Cooper in case there are some things that you and our audience feel like we should learn about him before we talk about the rest of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
On December 9th, 2022, Alice Cooper's official website announced that by fall of 2023, there would be published a 400-page autobiography called Starring Alice Cooper. As of this recording, this book does not exist. A week before that press release, it was announced that a book called Alice Cooper at 75 by Gary Graff would be published in January 2023 for Alice Cooper's 75th birthday. And that 208-page coffee table book does exist, but was not available through New Hampshire Interlibrary Loan. So all of tonight's information comes from two sources. First, remember that Dom DeLuise published a memoir that was a bunch of chatty anecdotes between recipes?
Vaguely, yes.
Yeah, well, in 2007, Alice Cooper published Alice Cooper, Golf Monster, a 12-step program towards using golf to help avoid alcoholism. It's literally a memoir, but it's mostly him talking about getting himself straight and the number of celebrities he's golfed with and what they said about his game at various points. The other main source was volume 58 of the Thompson Gale Encyclopedia, Contemporary Musicians. And this particular volume also featured entries on past trivia favorites Fiona Apple and Coheed and Cambria.
Interesting.
However, what inaccurate information is presented in that encyclopedia entry? A. Alice Cooper's birth date, December 25th, 1945. B. The name Alice Cooper was the name of a 17th century witch that it was believed he was the reincarnation of, and that's why he took that as his stage name. Or C. That he made his first two albums with Frank Zappa's record label Straight before switching to Warner Brothers Records in 1971. Or D, trick question, all of those are inaccurate. Or E, trick question, all of those are true.
How dare you, Ben? I was leaning towards the birthday one being inaccurate, but I also like them all being true. You double bluffing me. I don't think they're all lies. I do think that the Alice Cooper thing is true. They can't all be true if one of them is, or all lies if one of them is true. So yes, I'm going to stick with E. All of them are true.
Incorrect. Mm-hmm. I would have taken the birth date as a correct answer because it's definitely wrong.
Okay.
It's one of the myth-making aspects of Alice Cooper's devilish persona that it's ironic that he was born on Christmas Day, whereas that's just a lie that they put out in the press. He was actually born in February 4th, 1947.
Now that is
weird that he made himself older.
No, not only that, but wouldn't that timeline work out where that would also be Jesus' birthday?
I can't comment on that. The other two things, however, are vaguely inaccurate, and so I would have also accepted trick question, they're all inaccurate, in that there are a bunch of different stories that part of the fabrication and myth-making of Alice Cooper got told. The
which is probably why I recognize that.
Is as one of them that is told, but is also one that is not the official version of the story that the band uses.
Mm-hmm.
And he did release his first two albums with Frank Zappa's record label, and a third one, which was then re-released by Warner Brothers when they took over his contract. So it's both accurate and inaccurate.
How dare you?
You had 2 out of 5 opportunities to get that question right. Question number 2. In Alice Cooper, Golf Monster, which song sung by Kermit on The Muppet Show does Alice tell the story of performing with a celebrity? A, Happy Feet, which Alice performed on the Sonny and Cher Comedy Hour in 1974. B, I Won't Dance, the Jerome Kern jazz number, which he performed on the Brady Bunch Variety Show Hour in 1976. Or C, Lydia the Tattooed Lady, which he performed with Groucho Marx for a benefit.
All set with Happy Feet until you said Lydia the Tattooed Lady. Sure does fit in with his whole steez. But that might be the trap. I'm falling for the trap. C.
Correct.
Yes!
He had a great relationship with Groucho Marx. They did a lot of different things together. Groucho thought that he was the logical extension of vaudeville. It saw right through that his act was his act. And Alice goes on to tell a lengthy anecdote about how Groucho gave him the gift of a giant round sex bed, which he then gave to Paul McCartney.
Oh.
And when Groucho gave it to Alice, he said, I hope you have more luck with this than I ever did. But when Alice gave it to McCartney, he said, and when you're done with it, you should pass it on to somebody else. So this can just be the round sex bed that goes through as many famous people as possible.
Love it.
Question number three. True or false? Cooper first became interested in working with the Henson Company in 1975 when he was developing set pieces for the Welcome to My Nightmare stage show and for his ABC TV special of rock videos of that album. Henson Incorporated was invited to pitch on the massive spider puppet used in the song The Black Widow and the 9 to 10 foot cyclops that chased him around the stage for the song Escape.
I like what you've done here of giving me too many choices in question one and then limited it to a 50% option in question three.
Thank you.
It feels like you're evening the playing field, although I'm still probably going to get this wrong because I'm going to say true and hope it's true.
Unfortunately, it is false.
Yeah, bummer. Seemed too good to be true, but...
Question number four. Chapter 18 of Golf Monster opens with Cooper telling his story of being on The Muppet Show. Which is true of his recounting in that opening? A. He said that he felt the show had let down its portrayal of Vincent Price, his hero, and that he wanted to make sure he didn't look as cheap and shoddy in his musical numbers as he felt they did for Price. B. He said that, surprisingly, while CBS gave no notes about the references to the devil in their plotline, ITV received complaints from the Church of England, and specifically the Bishop of Canterbury said that the selling of souls should, quote, not be mocked, unquote. Or C, he said that he believed the reason why the show was so successful was that its concept was, quote, non-racial, unquote, and that he liked that you could be as stupid as you wanted and the audience would accept it.
One of those is true.
Correct.
I'm going to fall for another trap here, and hopefully I fall into the trap again of it being correct. And that I didn't really love the Vincent Price episode, so I'm going to hope neither did Alice, and that A is in fact true.
No, he was excited by his two heroes being on the show, Vincent Price and Peter Sellers, and that's why he wanted to be on the show, because he thought they were both great. No, he goes on at length about the fact that he thinks what's great about the show is that you have orange beings talking to green beings, talking to blue beings, that it's non-racial, and that it's so silly you can get away with anything.
Good answer. Was my second choice.
Alice Cooper has a very interesting film career in that he is a traditional 1970s persona who has about as many appearances as himself as he is playing characters. He wanted to be an actor. He had a big break in 1984 when he was cast as the main character in a Spanish luchador horror film, but it did not materialize into a longer film career that he was hoping for. But he also, because he's a musician, has fallen afoul to the now not uncommon stupid aspect of the IMDb algorithm, where it will list his most popular films that have his music in the soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
So, Pete,
yes.
Choose, if you want, Alice Cooper's top four results for when he plays himself in a movie. Or his top four results where he's playing a named character.
I feel like I'd do better with him as himself.
Okay. Alice Cooper's top four on IMDb where he plays himself on film are Rhodey from 1980, which received 5.2 stars on IMDb. And stars Meatloaf, Art Carney, Joe Spano, and Kirk Hunter, amongst others. Wayne's World from 1992, starring Mike Myers, Dana Carvey, Rob Lowe, Lara Flynn Boyle, Tia Carrere, and Colleen Camp, amongst others. Dark Shadows from 2012, starring Johnny Depp, Michelle Pfeiffer, Helena Bonham Carter, Chloe Grace Moretz, Christopher Lee, amongst others. And Diary of a Mad Housewife from 1970, starring Frank Langella, Richard Benjamin, and Carrie Snodgrass, amongst others. Using those people in those films or anybody else from those movies that you can remember, you have 60 seconds to connect Alice Cooper as Alice Cooper to Jim Henson, starting now.
I can't just say Michelle Pfeiffer to Jim Henson?
In what movie?
I don't know, Ben.
I've only said it 12 times.
I know, and I can't remember. Okay, well, I could do Michelle Pfeiffer to Harrison Ford in What Lies Beneath, and then Harrison Ford to Frank Oz in Star Wars Empire Strikes Back, and then Frank Oz to Jim Henson in the Muppet movie.
Time! You did it in 29 seconds, with 13 seconds of prevarication of not knowing what the name of Into the Night was. Congratulations.
I've never heard those three words before in my life.
Remember also that Michelle Pfeiffer is in Avengers Endgame, which allows you to connect her to a wide variety of actors who are in various things.
Before you said that,
yeah,
I was planning on using Meatloaf.
Mm-hmm. What's your good Meatloaf connection?
Fight Club, and then I mean, it's the one I can't use, but Eddie Baby to Frank Oz being directed by him, but that's directed.
But instead, he's in What with Daniel Craig, who's in something with Frank Oz.
Right. Yeah.
It's the extra step.
Yeah.
Whereas a shorter route is that Meatloaf is in Leap of Faith with Steve Martin.
Okay.
who's in the Muppet movie. Mike Myers is with Michael Caine in Goldmember, and Michael Caine is in The Muppet Christmas Carol with Frank Oz, who's in the Muppet movies with Jim Henson.
Mm-hmm.
And Colleen Camp I included specifically because she's in the very strange Peter Bogdanovich movie They All Laughed with Audrey Hepburn, who's in James Coburn with Sherrod, who's in the Muppet movie.
Yeah, that name was a name that I was like, that's so deep, I don't know who it is. He's obviously including it for a reason, but I would have never been able to pull any of those. I was kind of half expecting you to be like, yeah, and Colleen Camp is the star of the Muppet movie.
Movies that he appears in as a character and not himself include Sextet in 1997 as a singing waiter with Timothy Dalton, Tony Curtis, and Ringo Starr. Monster Dog, as previously mentioned, where he stars as Vincent Raven. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in 1978.
Okay, because in the first one I was like, oh, Ringo Starr, I can connect that to Sgt. Pepper, done.
Well, no, because Ringo Starr's not in Sgt. Pepper. Oh. None of the Beatles is in Sgt. Pepper.
Oh.
Ringo Starr, however, is in The Magic Christian with John Cleese, who's in The Great Muppet Caper with Jim Henson. He plays Father's Son in Sgt. Pepper's, and the person you always forget who is in Sgt. Pepper's is...
Steve Martin?
Correct.
I finally learned that.
He's also uncredited as Freddy's father in Freddy's Dead, The Final Nightmare in 1991, which features Yaphet Kotto, who's in Midnight Run with Charles Grodin, who's in The Great Muppet Caper as well.
I wouldn't know that. Except I would, because you've shown me that clip in the last 2 years.
Yeah, and you have reminded me of that the other day when I said, Charles Grodin, who's in Midnight Run with Fran Brill, who's in Follow That Bird, where you're like, yeah, also he's in The Great Muppet Caper. I'm so embarrassed right now. Alice Cooper is legendarily one of those people who has a onstage persona and is not like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike some of the people that have followed after him, who lived their devilish persona, or who were contemporaries with him, who, while they weren't satanic, weren't necessarily pleasant, he has always been a very normy conservative in his personal life, and that this has been a stage show that he puts on. He does a bit in the chapter before the chapter where he opens with the anecdote about the Muppet Show, where he talks about how he gets in his stage persona. And the answer is he watches a bunch of kung fu movies and then puts on his makeup.
Interesting.
He also has some interesting revelations about his alcoholism, including that when he went to therapy after being institutionalized for drunkenness in 1977 by his significant other, he said that Alice was the drunk, he wasn't.
Mm.
And his therapist said, "So how often do you drink when you're performing?" And he said, "Never. I don't drink at all when I'm performing. You can't drink and perform at the same time." And he said, "But you're only Alice on stage. You're not Alice in your personal life." And he said, "Yeah." And his therapist said, "So Alice isn't the drunk." And part of the reason he had been able to explain away and deny his alcoholic behavior was because he foisted it off on the persona. But his therapist helped show him that he was the person with the addiction. And in fact, Alice had nothing to do with it.
Mm.
And that was a huge moment that got him to turn around his perception and get control of his life again. So he did all of that basically within a year before appearing on The Muppet Show.
I mean, he looks good
mm-hmm.
on this episode.
It's interesting. Sometimes he looks young, sometimes he looks old. It's very much camera angles as to whether or not he's coming across as craggy or smooth-faced.
That was my comment in the cold open.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't going to look it up just in case it was part of questions. But I was like, okay, this is 1978. I don't know how old he is now. He could be 28. He could be 45.
Mm-hmm.
I have no concept of how old this man is.
I think he was 31. He was born in 47, then in 78. Yeah.
Okay, now knowing that, that's a rough 31.
Sometimes.
Yeah,
but
it's
sometimes
true.
He looks like a young man.
Yeah.
He just looks like a guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'll twist his neck or turn around and you'll see the deep grooves in the side of his cheeks and under his eyes.
Yeah.
But speaking of his first appearance in the dressing room, when Scooter opens the door and says 15 minutes to curtain.
Seconds.
Thank you.
That would be a very weird episode of the show.
Well, most of the episode, Kermit says how weird of an episode it is.
That's true.
If we had a 15-minute preamble and then they actually went to curtain at the ad break, that would be an interesting show.
It would be. And
I would
be,
tune in for that.
It'd be rivaling The Good Wife for longest cold opens.
But yes, as you say, 15 seconds. And this is where we first get to see Alice. And what's he doing in the dressing room?
Just getting ready. He has a snake around his neck. He's hanging out with some monsters.
And Scooter comes in and says, just to let you know, these aren't our Muppet monsters.
And Alice acknowledges this and says, I know, they're mine. And then it cuts to the curtain at 17 seconds after Scooter gave him the time call. So, good job.
But also you can say that Scooter broke protocol. Scooter was the one that was, like, ready to go and then got pulled back in by being worried about what was going on and then runs out screaming.
It's true. An interesting thing from the fandom page is that the snake around his neck mm-hmm. is a reference to his act.
Oh, okay.
He was very famous for performing with a boa constrictor around his neck, so having the Muppet snake there was kind of a self-referential Easter egg.
It's also the snakes that we saw in the UK spot in the previously aired episode where Robin is afraid of snakes. And those snakes looked normal and snake-like
mm-hmm.
when they were on the green screen and then looked way too big when they were on the bed. And here it's sort of in the between way too big and the right size as it's draped across his shoulder.
Yep. We cut to the curtain. Kermit gives his usual yay, but stops it a little early and gets scared and whimpers, which I found very fun.
The subtitles on the DVD are shutters.
Statler and Waldorf, it's another one of your episodes, and
yes.
We've got another Statler
yes.
and Waldorf.
I love it so much. Just with the weird luck of the draw yep. of the CBS New York broadcast order, because let's point out, that's not an absolute broadcast order. I'm spoiling for a fall. Sooner rather than later, I'm going to have some other terrible Muppet that I don't want to watch.
Yeah, you can only flip heads so many times statistically. And then they say that you got to admit the opening is catchy. Positive about the show.
And then Statler makes a pandemic joke, mm-hmm. which he says, so is smallpox.
Yeah. 45 years later, they'd make a COVID joke instead. And then Gonzo blows on his trumpet and a blue little spirit orb thing comes out because it's spooky.
It is. And the curtain comes up and Kermit says that their special guest star is one of the most talented but frightening performers. He says to beware of ghoulies and ghosties and long-legged beasties and things that go bump in the night. At which point, the lights go out and Kermit freaks out.
Yep.
Kermit is basically psyching himself into being scared here. Because the light going out, he normally would have, like, assumed it was a stagehand or Scooter or Animal or Crazy Harry and just yelled, like, hey guys, fix those lights. But instead, he's priming the pump to just be ready to give up. And, as the worst stage manager ever... Then just says, that does it, I'm leaving.
Rushes off the stage.
Doesn't try to fix the problem.
No.
Just abandons ship.
Yep. I can't defend you on this one, Kermit. I often try. Nah. We get the first Alice Cooper segment, which, as you said, is Welcome to My Nightmare. Alice is in a crypt performing this song. It has a monster band in the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
The spirit ghost that we've seen before comes out.
I'm not sure that's true. Because unlike just a happy, smiling sheet with hands, this is given legs specifically in order to mimic the dancing, where Alice is on the left-hand side of the screen, the ghost is on the right-hand, and they're basically doing each other's dance steps, and that would be less obvious if the ghost didn't have legs.
I didn't notice that the ghost had legs.
It definitely does. In fact, I had to stop and make sure it wasn't a mummy, because it's sort of layers of scaffolded, tattered cloth as opposed to just a simple sheet effect.
See, I didn't dislike this.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the song was fine. It's a song I was familiar with. I thought the choreography was simple but effective. But I would have liked it more, Ben, if I noticed that Muppet had legs. It would have bumped it up a bunch of notches.
Well, maybe you can give it some retroactive credit now that I've pointed that out.
Bold legs, make it a moment.
I will say that I thought that this was interesting on a couple of different technical levels.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt that most of the things that it accomplished, and the reason why I wrote the trivia question where somebody could have been critical of the Vincent Price episode the way we were...
Mm-hmm.
is that I felt like Alice had a lot of trust in the successful application of the technology.
Yeah.
Like, for him to be doing this took a degree of faith that this was going to look good when it was done. Imagine standing on that soundstage, it being mostly empty, and the director tells you, okay, I need you to stay in this quadrant because there's going to be a superimposed ghost dancer in this quadrant matching your movements, and doing the thing with the cape and walking back and forth and not feeling like, this looks so dumb right now.
Mm-hmm.
I sure hope it's gonna look better once they put in the lights and the music and everything else. Because he's not singing it. He's one of the better lip syncers we've had so far on the show, but he's definitely lip syncing.
Yeah, it was clear that he was lip syncing, but it wasn't distracting like other lip syncers.
Yeah, no, he's clearly, because of his 1975 special and in general, very practiced at rock videos in a way in which I feel like many artists in the 70s aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And so he has that extra level of performance chops to figure out something interesting to do with this song and to be good at the timing of it.
Yeah.
But I also recognized that it took a leap of faith to make this rock video and hope that it would be good.
There's also a weird edit where they do a wipe but the camera doesn't cut. I rewound it, was like, no, that's the same angle. They just did a circle edit.
I think they shot it 3 or 4 times and had successive wipes.
Mm.
Basically a locked off shot and they're wiping to and from the same, which I thought was such a cool effect.
Yeah, but it was just distracting at them in the moment of like, wait, that didn't do anything.
But it created a kind of surrealism, yes. which I thought reinforced the lyrics of the song.
Yeah, agreed.
My last note on this is somebody's playing the trumpet in the Undead Monster Band, And funny, it's not the session musician because Alice has brought his own monsters.
Right.
The monster playing the trumpet is referred to in the Muppet fandom page as the flower-eating monster, which is most clearly seen in this episode when it's dodging arrows in front of the dressing room doors.
Okay.
It's the big, dark, oblong-shaped head with the big teeth. On stage in this sketch, it basically just looks like a wad of darkness with two trumpets coming out of it. And so it took me a while to figure out what was going on there. I was literally, my first thought was, did they replace the Muppet band member with just a shadow? Is that how little they think of her? That, oh, just darkness can play the trumpet now. That's fine.
Well, I mean, yeah, it was Alice's band. They can't have the Muppet musicians sit in for them.
No.
But, to your point, is another statistic, another trumpet player. Statler and Waldorf chime in. Waldorf wants to know where he got the name Alice.
And Statler makes the joke that it's a family name. He was named after a maiden uncle.
I don't get it. Is maiden uncle a term?
No, but maiden aunt is.
I also don't know what that means.
A maiden aunt is an unmarried aunt.
Oh, okay.
And so you would be named after a maiden aunt because they would have no children of their own. But because it's a gender joke about a man being named Alice, which I think the episode plays the exact right amount of games with he has a girl's name in this episode. Mm-hmm. They make two jokes about it, but otherwise they don't make it a thing.
Yeah, but the jokes that they make aren't phobic about it. It's just, he has a girl's name.
Yeah. But it really struck me for the first time, because Alice is traditionally a girl's name, that Kermit always says Miss in front of a female performer and never says Mr. in front of a male performer.
Hmm.
And so he said,
hey, tonight our special guest star is one of the world's most talented but frightening performers, Alice Cooper.
And my brain said, why not Miss Alice Cooper? And then I was like, because it's not a miss. But that's what made me finally realize every woman is always Miss Florence Henderson. Which I've thought of before, because I've always thought it was weird that he's making the female performers feel like they are marryable, because that's what Miss means.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always been slightly weirded out by that, but now it's even stranger.
Well, it's just another example of him being a bad stage manager.
Well, or that the 70s were a different time.
Yeah, I mean, we'll get to it in a minute, but, you know, maybe a Muppet performer has to do a trial with no credit for a whole year, and maybe another Muppet performer gets credit on their first appearance.
Yeah, so, but that's, I did assume that you wouldn't be familiar with the phrase maiden aunt. It's a soft punchline anyway, but I did think that it was in line with the way in which they've made gender jokes before, in that the joke is they think it's perfectly normal.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that.
We go backstage. Kermit comments as Alice's monsters come off stage that it wasn't spooky like this when Julie Andrews did the show. Then calls for the next act to go on stage, which is a William Tell act.
William Tell is a blue whatnot with a ridiculous beard and hat. Like, perhaps the worst applied fake beard I've ever seen on a Muppet. And he says to Kermit, as his son wanders on stage holding an apple, don't shout, it makes me nervous. Which is good setup for something to go wrong on the Muppet Show.
Yes. The first time I watched this, I did not understand where these arrows were coming from.
Oh, the William Tell thing totally missed you.
I heard it. It just went right past me. And then I was like, well, that's weird. And then when they came back, I was like, okay. I was kind of tired the first time I watched this episode. Might have fallen asleep a little bit.
It did strike me as a little bit odd in that, thinking of the logistics of the act that we don't see.
Mm-hmm.
His son goes on first and he follows, which would make sense that therefore, on stage right,
yeah,
William Tell would be shooting stage left where his son is, which means the arrows would not be coming back to backstage where Kermit and Alice are.
But, Ben,
I can't believe I didn't think about this.
We've established that the Muppet Theater is a real House of Leaves situation. And therefore, you shoot the arrows off the stage left, they come back and hit stage right. No problem.
You're right. I can't believe I thought that was a criticism.
No, come on.
Then Alice also comes off stage after the Tell father and son have gone on stage. Kermit says that it must be great to be a rock star.
Alice asks Kermit if he wants to be a rock star, because he can make that happen. All he needs to do is sign a contract.
He has a friend who runs a service that could be sure to make him one.
Kermit waffles on this and says that, well, you know, I've also wanted to be an astronaut. And Alice has a good joke of being like, well, then cross out rock star and put astronaut.
See, I think this would have been funnier if he'd immediately produced a second contract.
Yeah.
That was like, we can do that too. There's something, I think it's more efficient when dealing with handing things to a Muppet, mm-hmm. to only hand them one thing for them to manipulate.
Yeah.
But there's something about the shadiness of you can just cross this out on a contract and write something in, even with what has not been explicitly mentioned so far at this level, a deal with the devil, that makes me think, like, hang on.
He just wants your signature. If you sign that, whatever's on that piece of paper, he gets your soul.
Well, we'll get back to that.
Mm. At this point, arrows start flying.
Yeah, there have been one or two arrows during Kermit's sort of waffle about, you know, I'm just basically saying it would be cool to be a rock star. It's not actually my dream. But it's at this point that an arrow actually pins the contract to the pillar leading up the stairs.
I want to pay attention to episodes that were produced after this to see if there are holes in either the door or this pillar. Because, yeah, they stuck these in. Mm-hmm. I'm also very impressed with Alice. I rewound this part a number of times to try and figure out if it was, like, an effect. They did a cut. And no, it's real. Mm-hmm. Like, they probably weren't standing far away. But it's definitely a bow and arrow going into the pole because Alice blinks his eyes just as it makes impact.
Do you remember when Gonzo's throwing knives at Peter Sellers?
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, the knife was in the wall and flipped up out of a slot.
Yep.
Whereas in this case,
in order to go through the paper, it had to go through the paper. So yeah, I was wondering if there was like one of those quick edits and they just went blink. But nope, it flies through. And I was very impressed with that. A couple more arrows come through. We hear someone like get injured by an arrow.
As one of the arrows strikes, Kermit says, talking to himself or to camera. And this is one of the ones that I wanted to ask you about. Do you feel like Kermit saying,
you must be kidding. Why, how can he guarantee that? And what must it cost?
Not a penny, just your soul.
Specifically, though, and what must it cost felt more to the audience, but it's not being delivered straight out.
Yeah, I didn't. Something later I counted as a camera take, but I did not count this.
At which point they then cut to an evil laugh and Alice standing in front of the dressing room door saying, not a penny, just your soul, and then he special effects out.
Mm-hmm.
Then Kermit says, I'm sure I didn't hear that. At which point there's another arrow and then somebody says, ow, in response to that.
Mm-hmm.
So his follow-up line is, but I'm sure I heard that. And that's when the tells come back on.
Which reveals that impact went through the son's head for our first hit of the episode. Because even though it happened off camera, we saw the result of it.
Okay.
So I'm counting it as a hit.
William Mattel says, if I told you once, I've told you 1,000 times. You can't move while I'm doing this. And the son says, well, you know me, Pa, in one ear and out the other.
Good joke. As they leave stage, Kermit looks at the camera and says, for our first time this season, a blank blank.
Weird. Weird show.
I was wondering if you were going to count that.
It was so obvious.
We cut back to Muppet Labs. This is our second or third occasion of what I've been calling the German Muppet Labs set, because beneath the crazily rotating clock with the bleeps and bloops, which for the first time it occurred to me it's probably supposed to be Oxford.
Mm.
But prior to this has looked to me like the castles that you have on German beer cans. Like, it looks like that kind of architecture.
I've never noticed outside the windows. Because I'm too busy watching the clock spin.
It's definitely an attempt at getting away from the beakers and labs and sort of UNIVAC computers of the previous season and moving towards something more academic and modern.
Mm.
And we have, after the normal, where the future is being made today, patter, perhaps our first proper meep from Beaker.
Oh, really?
Well,
because in the past we've said he hasn't quite established his catchphrase at this bit.
Uh-huh.
But when Bunsen finishes his line, Beaker just says the one meep noise, and then Bunsen looks at him, Beaker looks at him, and Bunsen goes, and then continues talking.
Hmm. Didn't notice it. Probably, again, because it's so ingrained in my brain. That I was just like, oh, yeah, good.
No, I think this is the first.
Hmm.
In production order, there are only 6 episodes before this, so we'll check to see if there are any Muppet Labs that we haven't watched yet in that gap. But
yeah, based off of our previous discussions, yeah, we haven't talked about Beaker meeping yet.
Yeah.
Anyway, this week they are getting rid of using microscopes because Bunsen has created a germ enlarger so they can better study viruses. And he uses it on the germ, and as predicted, the germ gets too big.
I like that Bunsen says that Beaker can now perfectly study the germ and then takes a beat and says, or vice versa, because exactly what's happening is this deadly germ is trying to absorb slash attack Beaker. The wipe that they use in order to go from Beaker standing in front of the Petri dish to being enveloped with a germ is basically the same wipe that they used on Alice. Like, it's that same kind of fade wipe from the middle.
Yeah, they're using that all over this episode.
But it's such a good effect because it does make it feel like it grows.
Mm-hmm. And that's it. We leave with Beaker struggling and we cut backstage. And Beaker comes off stage still struggling with the virus.
Well, it's strange that after Bunsen wraps up, he says,
that's all for now from Muppet Labs. Well, Beaker.
Well, Beaker, as if he's about to say something else. Then there's the cut to backstage, and Beaker comes off. Like, it really ends the sketch with Bunsen about to do something else, and then the vectors of it are all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Bunsen's turning to screen right, and yet then they're coming from screen right off stage to screen left. I have a lot of praise for the direction of this episode, but this transition drives me crazy. It's like, it's almost like they cut one last joke.
They probably did, yeah. I didn't place it, but with that description, they had to have, yeah.
Or Dave was improvising and they were like, no.
Yeah, because Bunsen usually doesn't have sympathy or empathy for Beaker's struggles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like he would have just said, well, Beaker, like,
it's a very odd half moment.
So yeah, we go backstage, Beaker's exiting, still struggling with the virus. And then we see Gonzo is reading the contract still on the stairway pillar. He's intrigued by the contract, but despite all the negatives, he only hears positives as Kermit tries to talk him out of signing this piece of paper.
Yeah, because the contract promises riches and worldwide fame. And when Kermit compares it to the Faust story, which he says, you know the Faust story? And Gonzo looks at him and says, no, which is the perfect response for children and family television. Like, the fact that they're bringing it up so blasé as if most of their audience would recognize it, I think that is the only way to continue with this particular metaphor. But they're very quickly basically saying he sells the soul to the devil. But his description is that he then becomes rich and very famous. And as you say, that's all Gonzo cares about.
Yeah.
So much so that as he's desperately trying to find a pen in order to sign the contract, he says both that he will give up a chicken for a pen and then all of his chickens for a pen.
Because he'll have all the riches. He can get more chickens.
Yeah, I'm going to later talk about a sketch as perhaps the best exemplar of the character dynamics that I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
This one, I can't picture Gonzo actually
giving away his chickens.
or being that interested in fame and riches. It goes against his whole starving artist persona.
Yeah, maybe he's just sick of it.
He's always cared more about achieving greatness than being adored by millions.
Faust sold his soul to the devil and in return became very rich and very famous. And Alice says that this is that kind of a contract.
Really? Where do I sign?
And so for him to throw all that away without any writing to the idea of, like, he's being seduced by infernal powers and going against his better judgment, because that's literally not what Gonzo wants.
He does want adoration.
He does, but he'd rather have adoration from two of the right people than be loved by the whole world for something that isn't part of his weird métier.
But with this contract, he would be able to perform and everyone would love what he does.
Yep.
So therefore, he is getting best of both worlds. Whatever weird thing he does, people are going to love it.
But also, rubes and yokels will love it, and he's never cared what they thought.
Yeah, but they'll like the weird thing that he does. Yeah, so maybe the rubes and yokels are learning. They're growing.
No. In my conception, based on previous evidence of who Gonzo's character is, he wouldn't want to be liked by rubes and yokels. And so, since they are part of everyone, this is the wrong thing for Gonzo to want.
See, I think I agree with you with the riches, but I think the adoration is the thing that... What they should have done is dropped the riches and just gone with, people will finally understand what I'm doing.
Literally, if that was the line, mm-hmm. I would have been wholly on board with this. Even for him being like, I'll sacrifice all my chickens to this, I would have been like, yeah, I grudgingly admit that he would go that far.
Mm-hmm. While Gonzo is pleading, he does look directly to camera for another camera take. And then we go to a very weird sketch. Not set up. We just cut to teeth. The only reason we know their teeth is because we're told their teeth.
I've never known a toothache this bad before.
He's never known a toothache this bad before.
It's like having toothache all over my body.
I don't think they're teeth.
But they say it's called the tooth sketch.
I think they're stalactites and stalagmites.
Well, yeah, but... It's not clear what they are. Because also, Ben, here's an easy joke.
Yeah?
This is published and made in England.
Yeah.
So to me, these look like British teeth.
Wow. Wow. If you're trying to get us canceled... Right when we're finally able to get back on the air.
Listen, I said it was the easy joke.
Fair. No, I think it's clear by looking at them with relationship to the background that they are surrounded by, that the little proscenium lip and what's going on behind them, that they're in a cave. They're not in a mouth.
I truly had no idea what I was looking at this entire time.
I have a... totally unsubstantiated theory mm-hmm. as to what this sketch is.
Yeah.
This is an SNL sketch that never got used, and they just decided to dust it off.
Yeah, it's weird. I liked some parts of it,
mm-hmm.
and then I didn't get... My note says, I didn't get or like the teeth having teeth for the ending.
Okay, but is it better or worse that a stalactite would have teeth? Or would have mini stalactites within it that yeah. sort of featured
See,
as
See, that
teeth.
Makes even less sense to me.
Pete, it's all just a locker in the changing room in the Men in Black headquarters.
Yeah. None of the... Okay, not none of this worked for me, but very little of this worked for me.
But you liked specifically the bit where he says, sometimes I can't hear the voices, and then they don't say anything.
Uh-huh.
And when they say...
And sometimes
it says what I'm going to say before I said it.
It says what I'm going to... Yeah.
And then he gets confused by the temporal loop.
You nailed the two things that I liked in this. 100%.
Yeah, they're the best jokes in the sketch.
Uh-huh.
But it is definitely, it's difficult to say it's weird for weirdness' sake, mm-hmm. because its purpose is to be a joke delivery system. It's not just to be weird. But it has created a premise that is so weird, as far as I can tell, so that they can get away with really off-the-wall jokes. They're so... I don't know if you can say this about stalagmites, so not grounded
I gotta go.
That it's essentially gives them the ability to just be weird in order to be funny.
This felt like a first season Muppet Show sketch to me.
Which is why I think it feels like a pre-first season Muppet Show sketch, which is a Saturday Night Live sketch.
Mm-hmm.
The writing credits on this episode are Jerry Jewell, Chris Langham, Jim Henson, and Don Hinckley, which is not atypical for season three. Sometimes there is a fifth writer who gets slotted in season three credits, but as far as I know, there's no Joseph Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, at large, this episode deals heavily in weirdness.
Mm-hmm.
And so if this is from early Weird, it would have to be a Jerry Jewell script or a Jim Henson script
yep.
that they were pulling out. But it also does have some of the Chris Langham oddity quality that I've been noticing a little bit this season.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows?
No.
It would be wild speculation to claim one way or the other.
All right, you won me over. I like it again. After the weird teeth thing, we go back to the dressing room where Sam is berating Alice for being a freako.
Mm-hmm.
Alice is proud of being a freako, which immediately defuses Sam.
He has no power over a person who is loud and proud.
Nope. Alice looks directly at camera as he makes an invisible tally for winning one for the freakos.
Pete?
Yep.
As our resident punch-up expert.
Okay.
Do you think this would have been better if there was like a special effect of fire that came down with his finger in the air as he drew the one to tally up that Freakos did better?
I do agree with that, yes.
If they had really leaned into the Alice is Satan's salesman
mm-hmm.
and that he had that magic power.
It would have been good.
Okay.
Yep. A plus.
What if it was in the same color as the blue wavering orb that Gonzo blew at the beginning?
No, needs to be fire.
I agree.
Yep.
We cut from that to the cafeteria, where Gladys is asking who ordered the spider sandwich.
Fozzie laments about how spooky tonight's show is, and he wishes that they could just have something nice.
He does say, however, that he's glad that he's able to sit here in the canteen with these clean-cut kids. And the four people in skirts and suits around him all open their mouths to reveal rows of sharp pointed teeth.
Which, again, this is filmed in England, so they could just be British people, Ben.
Easy
joke number two.
I don't think that British teeth typically could be described as fangs.
I've seen some pretty fangy British gnarly teeth.
Well, you are further ahead in Taskmaster than I am, so I haven't noticed any yet.
Alex Horn has some pretty fangy teeth.
Alex Horn has a noticeable jagged front door in his teeth, but I still wouldn't refer to it as sharp.
No little pills, though. He doesn't have any jagged little pills.
Isn't that ironic?
Mm.
Don't you think? At the end of Fozzie complaining that he wished that there was something nice and wholesome, there is a fade to a green grassy slope over a body of water with Robin sitting on there, and he goes into, as you mentioned earlier, Over the Rainbow.
Mm-hmm.
By Harold Arlen and E.Y. Harburg from 1938's The Wiz, Erd of Oz. I did check to see whether or not there was anything contemporary that might have brought this to popular attention, or whether or not somebody was just like, what is the most wholesome song we can come up with that would be an antidote to Alice Cooper?
Mm-hmm.
In 1978, it was on an album by Shirley Bassey, but I don't know, A, whether it was released prior to the March filming of 1978, or B, how it did in the charts, because weirdly enough, it doesn't have a Wikipedia entry.
Hmm.
All of Shirley Bassey's other albums do, and it mysteriously has no footprint whatsoever within her catalog.
Wow.
I clicked around a lot trying to figure out what the heck, why this didn't have an entry, and was not able to come to a satisfactory answer.
See, I watched this and was convinced that they'd performed the song before.
Mm.
So I clicked in the fandom page and was like, no, they haven't. And this is why I thought they mentioned Julie Andrews as well earlier. Because I was like, oh, it must be from the Julie Andrews episode. No, it's not.
I think this is a combination of two things. One, they did It's Not Easy Being Green,
mm-hmm.
and the way in which that song is performed is going from the empty stage to a fabricated green environment to a more realistic, natural environment over the course of the performance of the song, that in stages it becomes more and more real.
Mm-hmm.
But also, this feels 100% like a dry run for the filming of the opening of the Muppet movie, which is famously Kermit sitting over a body of water, mm-hmm. singing to and looking at his reflection, and it's a song about rainbows.
Mm-hmm.
And so, obviously, we've talked before about when they did the camera tests, a lot of it was about natural light, outdoors, working in natural environments. Does the fabric look right, or do we need to do something else with this? Doing this in studio wouldn't achieve most of those goals. But visually and conceptually, what the camera does in terms of panning between Robin and his reflection,
mm-hmm.
of having the bank that he's sitting on look as much like real mud and dirt and grass as possible, feels like them working out some of the kinks of what they were going to do in the Muppet movie, literally just a couple of weeks later. Because, as we've mentioned many times, the first couple weeks of April, they burn through 8 recording sessions in 6 weeks so that they can then go to America and work early prep on the Muppet movie.
Yeah.
This was filmed 4 days before that epic 8 episodes in 6 weeks, so it really feels like in their minds, this would have been part of the, well, why don't we road test this?
Also, now maybe it is from the Muppet movie, but I feel like I've seen this before.
Okay.
But according to the fandom page, when this episode gets compiled into the
video cassette collections?
Yes. There's the Best of Muppet Show Monster Laughs.
Huh.
This segment is pulled out of it because it's not spooky.
Right.
So
it's not in the other Muppet Treasures collections.
Nope, but this is not in that compilation, and the Fozzie part before it is not in him asking, "Oh, couldn't there be something nice?" No, nothing nice happens in the subsequent publishings.
At the conclusion of this number, there's a fade to black, which means it's the ad break, and we come back up to backstage, which is a little bit of banter with Kermit and a candle before we then go to a very short musical number.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming all of this is the UK spot.
It is all the UK spot.
How long is the musical song, which is called Once a Year Day?
1.63 minutes.
And how long is the sketch before that?
I don't time non-music, Ben, but I would guess 0.39 minutes.
The bit is that there's a candle scraping across the desk. It's making weird creaking noises when it moves to make it extra spooky.
Mm-hmm.
And then Kermit blows out the candle and immediately looks to camera and says,
"Think about that, folks."
Mm-hmm. Which, it's true. I was totally taken in by him blowing out the candle until he pointed it out, and then I had a brain explosion. I watched it 3 times in a row. I'm not quite sure how they did it. Either way, the timing is perfect.
Mm-hmm. Then some monsters with skull masks start popping up and scare Kermit away before breaking into the song that you titled earlier, Once a Year Day.
Interestingly enough, to me, this is sung primarily by the Blue Frackle, wearing mm-hmm. one of the skull masks, and one of the members of the Alice Cooper Scary Band, as voiced by Jerry Nelson.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically the rest of all of the characters in this musical number are from the Scary Group, except then Thog comes on.
Yep.
And so while we open the episode with Scooter saying, "Those aren't our monsters," now halfway through the episode, we have a blending of the Muppet monsters and the Cooper monsters together.
Yep. I love Thog. Also, so as I alluded to earlier,
mm-hmm.
Steve Whitmire is Thog.
Okay.
Even though we saw him and heard him earlier, this episode was recorded prior. So this is the onstage debut of Steve Whitmire.
All right, because I definitely checked the performer credits for this episode because I was surprised by Louise Gold's prominent vocal performance later in the show, and I believe next in the show.
Mm-hmm.
And because I know that she's English, and the vocal performance of the singer in that song didn't sound like an English voice to me. And so I was paying particular attention to see if there was a guest puppeteer listed. As you're pointing out, just because somebody performs on the show doesn't mean they're going to be in the credits.
So, yep. Congratulations, Steve. Your first appearance on the show, you get credit in the end credits, too.
Once a Year Day is from The Pajama Game by Richard Adler and Jerry Ross. The Pajama Game has one other song that's mildly well-known, which is called Hernando's Hideaway. Hernando's Hideaway, to a certain kind of nerd, is known specifically because it's in iambic tetrameter, which is the same meter as Robert Frost's Stopping in the Woods on the Snowy Evening.
Okay.
And so when English teachers are trying to teach meter and foot and poetic feet, they often bring up Hernando's Hideaway like it's a song that anyone's ever heard of. But because The Pajama Game is beloved by some, but unjustly beloved, it's...
I mean, I love Sleepover, so it makes sense that The Pajama Game is, you know, other people like that.
I took a look at a YouTube video excerpt of this song performed by Doris Day and whoever the romantic lead is in The Pajama Game, and it was one of the worst performances I've ever seen put to film. The original stage production, which was choreographed by Bob Fosse, may have been great, but this film looked like hot garbage in terms of this 2-minute segment that I watched. This song is catchy. That film version ruined it. I thought that this was fun, if inessential.
Yeah, it's a UK spot. Except a good one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, as we say, we go to the middle Alice Cooper ballad.
Which there is a weird, so as you often like to bring up with UK spots, there's a fade up and then a fade out. And in this one, it then ends on the candle again, and then Alice Cooper appears over it with applause. I would be curious as to see what the American audience saw, if it came back up and there's a candle and then a wipe to Alice.
I assumed it was black to candle to Alice.
Yeah.
As opposed to Once a Year Day, the stage fading to black to candle to palace.
Yeah. It's just, it works as a unit for once.
Uh-huh.
And I was really impressed with that.
But you're also not wrong that the applause would be extra weird coming back from commercial.
Mm-hmm.
So.
I'd like to take you to heaven. That would make my day complete. But you and me ain't no movie stars.
This is kind of a sweet romantic song.
Which is why I didn't think it was an Alice Cooper song. I thought this must be someone else that he was like, yeah, this will be fun.
And it's Alice lying in bed, entangled with a very strange bird puppet that is a weird metal beak that's either bumpy or bejeweled. And then big feminine eyes with long lashes and a multicolored clown wig over a stretched out series of feathery limbs.
The character's name is Beaky.
Yep, that checks out.
Yep.
And is sung by, very well, by Louise Gold.
Do you have in the original version, is this a duet? And who sings it in the Alice Cooper version?
It's from the 77 album Lace and Whiskey. The music video that was produced at the time is Alice as himself on a television and as a private eye that gets killed by a femme fatale. And it wasn't noticeably a duet in the clips that I skimmed through. I think it is more deliberately adapted as two people singing to each other in this version than it is in the original.
Interesting. Yeah, I liked this. It should fall in the Pete thinks it's boring category, but it's unsettling enough to keep me interested because, yeah, Beaky is very weird.
And yet they have chemistry.
Yeah. And, like, the camera's doing enough interesting things of, like, being over them and looking down, so you get to see the whole unsettling spread of how they're splayed out after assumingly doing certain acts to each other.
Or before.
But it seems like they're in a very post-coital glow.
And from my own anecdotal experience of drama programs in high school, the dressing room / costume loft is the best place to get busy.
But Scooter doesn't respect those boundaries and just barges in, saying that it's pretty dark in there.
Turns on the light and says, "Miss Piggy, it's call for pigs in space."
And at that point, even though we've heard Beaky sing in not Miss Piggy's voice, Miss Piggy's voice comes out of Beaky in speaking.
"Miss Piggy wanted on stage for pigs in space."
"I'll be right there." "Pardon moi, Alissimo."
Before noticing her reflection in the mirror.
The only way this joke works is if Frank isn't doing the duet.
It's true.
So it makes sense that whatever the terms of the agreement were, when we soon discover that Piggy says, "Forget it, Cooper, I'm canceling the contract," whatever she had asked for, fame, fortune, a perfect performance voice, whatever, that transformed her also transformed her voice in this way.
So yeah, she...
But let's assume she signed the contract. She broke it like no trouble. Like, that was my counterpoint to your earlier thing of, is a contract is a contract? Is apparently not. Apparently all you have to do is say, "I'm out."
Well, maybe it was a trial run, you know, try it before you buy it. Yeah.
Yeah, or maybe... Even Alice Cooper is afraid of the possibility of karate chops.
Yeah. So yeah, she gets turned back into herself with an explosion.
Mm.
And then says to Alice, "Tell your man I wouldn't sell you my soul if you paid me." Then she calls him a creep.
Yep.
Now, Ben.
Yes.
I think he should then once again look directly to camera. And as you said, draw another point. Mm.
At, for creeps.
Yes. So now he's got one for the freakos and one for the creeps.
Yeah, but instead, unlike Sam, also played by Frank Oz, calling him a freako, where he's proud of it, when Piggy says, "I wouldn't sell my soul to you no matter what," and then comes off, then comes back in order to deliver the word creep, he seems hurt.
Yeah.
So,
but my punch-up would have been, he should have taken that as also a badge of honor.
If they went in that direction, but instead the direction was he is hurt by the loss of his weird feathered paramour now turned back into her normal form.
Mm-hmm.
It's enough that that does hit him in the heart.
Yeah.
And that's when he gets on a radio that's sitting there, talks into the corded mic attached to it, and says, "Boss, no, sorry, I didn't make a sale, but do I still get commission on hourly rentals?" At which point the radio jets a huge flame out from behind it. And then there's a close-up as directly to camera, Cooper says, "Touchy."
So I think this is why the contract wasn't signed, was Piggy was trying it out. She was renting the voice.
I think he's trying to make the best of a bad situation.
Oh, well, yeah.
That he must have not actually closed the deal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so maybe he can call it a rental? The rules are faster and looser than most devil contracts in fiction are.
I think that's a Ted Nugent song.
Faster and looser?
Fast and loose, maybe? I don't know. Sounds like it.
I bet Ted Nugent and Alice Cooper have a lot of political crossover.
Motorhead had a song called Fast and Loose, sorry.
But but for the purposes of a joke, the idea that Alice is kind of a bad salesman is a lot of fun.
Yeah, he's a bad... you're right. It's a good game. I like it a lot.
It's just too bad this is really the only occasion of it.
Yeah. We get kind of a glimpse with the Kermit thing of him trying to do it, but it's obviously not going to work on Kermit.
But that's introducing the concept in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So in our game of three, we have introduction of concept,
heightening,
and then it comes back at the end with Gonzo with having
a twist.
So I suppose that's perfectly in format.
Mm-hmm.
But what we don't really see is the other version of this joke, which is a series of failures,
right,
which is how a lot of these jokes are structured. you could have had a backstage segment where you had a couple of other Muppets also transformed and Kermit saying, why did you sign the contract? I need you to get on stage right now, but you're in armor, you know, or whatever. That could have been the running bit, is all the different people that took it and what the side effects were.
Yeah, they could have made that the Electric Mayhem were the monsters.
Mm-hmm. And then they transformed back. But instead, we really only have this one failure. And I thought that Cooper, when he does his scary laugh fade in front of the door, and when he first turns around and does the, oh, so you'd like to be rich and famous? Like, he's really on point as seductive, good salesman. And then the rest of it, he's kind of a milksop.
Yeah.
And so balancing the level of, is he good at his job? Is he not good at his job? The episode never really finds its temperature for how good or bad is he at it.
This might be a curse of his own doing. Mm-hmm. Because I think if he weren't Alice Cooper, meaning his segments need to be his songs, and he was doing more bits, or if he was doing a sketch, I bet that would have happened. But because he's a rock star and he does three of his songs, like, we're probably lucky to really get these other segments anyway. Mm. Because most of the time,
yeah, that they did this song short enough that they could do the sketch after it.
Because usually it's three major pieces and then maybe something else. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like we get a fair amount of Alice Cooper. It's just we would have liked other parts more.
And I think they do a good enough job of Alice playing with his persona.
Absolutely.
That this is very much a fine-tuned quibble of me saying they could have done more with it if they'd committed more to the bit or found a different level. But they're already subverting expectations by having Alice be both devilish and a bit of a goof.
Yeah, absolutely.
The next segment is what Piggy was called on stage for, Pigs in Space. And the announcer tells us that the last time we left the Swine Trek, Captain Hogthrob was suffering from a mysterious space disease, and Strange Pork needs Piggy to wheel him to the Electrocosmotron so that they can use shock treatment to try and get rid of the disease. When they do this, there's an additional fascinating special effect, whereas Link basically turns into a line drawing on screen.
And every time someone touches him, the effect transfers to them as well. It's a really odd effect.
It's really cool looking.
Yeah, agreed.
It's more successful on Link than I think the other two characters, weirdly enough. I don't know what it is about either his lighting or the construction of their outfits that had more folds or more...
Like, Piggy's hair doesn't get picked up very well.
And she's got the lines in her dress. I think there's something about the way in which either the light or the multiple layers of her puppet made her harder to translate. But in general, the effect of them being sort of squiggly computer lines that can be totally seen through when used on a blue screen with a background is so cool.
Yeah.
But look at me. I'm just a shell of my former self.
You're much more interesting.
No, I think it looks weird.
Plus the additional effect of their voices being modulated to be electronically hollow when they're in the electro-cosmotron form.
Tron was 80?
Four, I believe.
Okay. So, yeah.
Maybe 82.
It seems like a very early Tron effect.
Mm.
Like, Tron then took this idea and was like, oh, that's cool. We can do this better. Also, I'd like to note that the way he transfers it to Piggy is by asking for a kissy-kissy.
Yep.
So, logged a kissy-kissy. Our first one in, like, two seasons.
This is what I was talking earlier about in terms of hitting the tone right on.
Mm-hmm.
Link has a line where he says, I look more interesting, but you just look weird. Which is just the perfect quintessence of Link, of like, he sees the same thing happen to him as to happen to somebody else. That's a terrible thing. But on me, because I'm awesome, it must be awesome, is so essentially him. And Piggy, early on, is radiating concern for Hogthrob, somebody for whom we know she has nothing but contempt. But because it's her job to be in a melodrama, she's going, oh, what do we do? And then the second she has to maybe sacrifice some aspect of herself when Strangeport goes,
is there no alternative?
Well, you could give him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
You connect the wires, I'll throw a switch.
That transition of she's playing a part, but she can't maintain the part because the reality of her own personality strikes through is, again, exactly what I want from every Pigs in Space sketch. Mm-hmm. I want Link to be stupid and egotistical. I want Piggy to be in a soap opera, except that she can't maintain character. And I want Strange Pork to be so basic that he can't not just talk about the reality of the situation and, like, refuses to engage in the humor at all. He's just like, no, facts and figures. He's obviously Mr. Spock, in that Mr. Spock is no emotion. That's his whole characteristic. And Strange Pork's adaptation of that to just be like, there are no jokes here. There is only the script. I love so much.
See, I'd like Strange Pork to be Dr. Spock and just really give advice on how to raise children in the 70s and 80s.
It would be a very strange thing, unless, of course, he's following up on Mama, Baba, Poop, Poop, Chihuahua in Muppets Take Manhattan.
Yeah, I would love that.
Ah, so once you are all little baby forms of yourself, here is what you need to do.
Literally is my favorite Muppet thing of all time.
Then whatever they've done to themselves also spreads to the ship.
Yeah, unexplained. It just happens. Like, at least when it goes to Strange Pork, it's because Piggy hi-yahs him.
Uh-huh.
They don't go and touch the ship, except that they are touching the ship because they're standing on it. But
there's a bunch of shouting and squawking once Strange Pork has turned, and Piggy in the tumult says, oh no, something's happening to the spaceship, right before it happens.
Yeah.
But the timing is just off.
Yeah, there needed to be an action that spread it to the ship. I get that they didn't have time or something.
They're just cramming it all.
Yeah, they just want to use their cool effect to the maximum.
And it's real cool on the spaceship, because then unlike the white lines of them, it's this cool purple.
Yeah.
It's brilliant.
Yeah, it's great. However, Statler and Waldorf had thoughts on it.
Yeah, Waldorf asks, what did you think about that?
Statler names the 1998 movie Out of Sight.
Waldorf says, wait, so you're saying you liked it? Because Out of Sight is great.
Statler says, no, I had my eyes closed.
And then we go back to Curtin, where Kermit comes out and says,
and now for one last time, Alice Cooper.
Because he's being a terrible stagehand.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yeah.
As I previously mentioned, this is School's Out, which also, in addition to being the UK number one for 3 weeks, was the number two Billboard Hot 100 single when it was released on April 26th of 1972. So this is maybe the most successful Alice Cooper band song out there.
Yeah, 100%.
We're back to the mausoleum set, but instead of the earlier sort of storm color that we had on the scrim, we now have a sunset hue. And
we have a wider shot, so you can see it as part of a bigger stage.
Mm-hmm. And we have a mutation, Timmy Monster, the lunch counter monster, one of the two Maurice Sendak wild things, and Sweetums all come out and dance. And as we get to the end of the first verse where they talk about blowing up the school, then Thog comes out looking bashful with a sparkler, and there's an explosion.
Two explosions.
They then repeat the verse again, and I assume that's where the second explosion happens. Or there are two explosions the first time. And
yeah,
Thog
lights something, it explodes, and as he walks away, there's a second burst of light that I counted.
The other transition that happens is that when Alice is singing the first verse, he's acting a little scared of the monsters, and he's wearing a mortarboard and a graduation robe. And then they tear off the robe in the second verse, revealing a red satanic wrestling unitard with a tail. And then he's really sort of joining in with everything at the second verse.
And then, once again, when they say school's out forever, another explosion happens, and rubble falls on them and hitting six people in Muppets.
It's supposed to be paper and books. I think the implication is that the school that's blown up in the background, this all rains down on them, but
I didn't get any of that.
It doesn't work in terms of physics and trajectory. So,
but Ben,
Pete, while the Muppet Theater is a Real House of Leaves situation, is this mausoleum and that school?
It's very clearly the stage, Ben. It's the stage
it's
that they're on.
It's a fictional set within the theater.
The stage
has never been a House of Leaves situation within the stage.
I do not accept your quibble.
We then cut back to Curtin, and Kermit's saying that tonight was very strange, but...
Even for the Muppet Show.
But, yeah, that's right. Because most of this season, he's been a little down on his own production, and so he can't escape that here. He also says, but before we all go home and hide under our bed, let's bring out Alice Cooper, who then warps in, holding a pitchfork and wearing a black top hat in addition to his satanic onesie.
And then all the various monster creatures that he's been hanging out with all episode join him. And then some thunder and lightning happens as Gonzo's voice comes booming over the loudspeaker saying, "This is the voice of doom!" And then with another explosion, Gonzo appears. And Gonzo's holding the contract that we've seen, or so we think.
But twist, as you said earlier.
Yep, it's not the contract with the devil. It's worse than that. It's the bill from tonight's special effects.
Gonzo weirdly just runs up and glares into the camera for no reason. Doesn't say a line. Just gets real close.
And then unfolds the bill. And you can not really see it, but it's very long as the credits roll.
And then jumps back into the throng as the credits roll up.
Then we have our last Statler and Waldorf segment, where Statler says, "So that was Alice Cooper."
And Waldorf says, "You should see his sister, James Fenimore." Which I also think he says directly to camera.
Yeah, I'll allow it.
It's a turn. He says, "You should see his sister, turn James Fenimore."
Adding it now.
So that's pretty much it. The question is we've talked about explosions and hits and hi-yahs and various other things, but I didn't keep track while we were doing it. Pete, can you summarize numerically what we needed to pay attention to this episode in terms of stats?
Well, lucky for you, Ben, I did keep track of all of those things. Also, something that you like to say sometimes, this episode is a bingo.
Is it?
It is the seventh episode production order, and it is our seventh episode.
Yes, it is.
Lucky number 11.
Unlucky for Kermit, lucky for some.
Mm-hmm. So, for some numbers, there were 7 hits, 5 explosions, no falls, no kisses, despite Alice Cooper making kissy-kissy faces at Beaky.
But what about the nose-to-nose touch between... Oh, but that's not a human Muppet kiss.
Exactly. Yeah, Alice makes a kissy face but misses the beak.
Got it.
So, therefore, no contact is made, not a kiss. 8 camera takes, 1 kissy-kissy, 1 weird-weird. For music, despite being an episode starring a musician...
That mostly features their music?
Yep. There is 13.64 minutes of music this episode out of 26.43 minutes of episode for 51.61% music. That's our third highest percentage of music so far.
Huh.
So a lot, but not the most. As for rank,
is that what third highest means?
Yeah.
A lot, but not the most.
Yeah,
how elegantly you put it.
I'm good with things
and stuff.
No, I'm elegant with stuff. I'm
but good with things.
In the discussion of this episode, Ben, I actually changed my ranking.
Oh.
I originally put Alice Cooper at 16, but then talking about mostly the segment with Beaky, which I did always like. It's that connection that he made and like his interactions with the big Muppets. Even though that first segment he didn't really interact with the Muppets he was dancing with, he did a good job, so I bumped him up to 12.
Yeah, I got no problem with that.
So we got 10, 11, 12 locked in.
Who are those?
Helen Reddy 10, Loretta Lynn 11, Alice Cooper 12.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's a musician block.
I have no recollection of who Helen Reddy is.
Australian singer.
Sure. I believe you.
But interesting that the most well-known and perhaps with the longest staying power as a professional is the third of three of those musicians.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I think that's in part because he falls foul to your traditional criticism, which is doing too much of his shtick that he does outside of the show.
Yeah, but he did bits.
He did bits. Look, I'm not... So, I think Middle of the Pack is a fine record for him.
Which he's is not, why I had to raise him above 16.
He's not elevated. He is doing things beyond just what he does.
Mm-hmm.
He's game, but he's not expert.
Yeah. And one of the notes I made in that first segment, Welcome to My Nightmare, is he's not just standing singing,
nope.
Which oftentimes the singers do. They let the Muppets do things around them, and he is exploring the space. Yeah. He's having a blast.
He is a video performer, mm-hmm. and he's using that to his advantage throughout the episode.
Yeah. It was too harsh of a rating, so I had to bring him up.
Good. As always, we end each episode by focusing in on our five favorite individual moments that are not a full sketch, but a piece of production or performance that we want to highlight. Pete, why don't you start with your first of five?
For my first moment, our first moment, our first of five moments, as you just said, I want to talk about Gonzo. Specifically, when he really, really wanted to sign that contract. When he's desperately looking for a pen, mm-hmm. he says,
I've got to get a pen. Hey, give me a pen. Look, and I'll give you a chicken for a pen. I'll give you all my chickens for a pen. I'll sell my soul for a pen. No, I have other plans for that.
Such a good bit.
Yeah, amazing.
Such a good piece of both performance, but also awareness by the writer. Mm. It is one of the best escalations of... Nope, we went too far. We need to go back down.
And he's so excited to sell his soul for a pen, and then immediately realizes, nope, I have other plans for that. Perfect delivery.
Yeah, co-signed.
Yep. Uh-oh. Does that mean we both lose our souls to the devil now?
No, because I didn't co-sign that contract.
Oh, okay. Whew.
I co-signed that ranking of the first of five nights at Freddy's. I'm sorry, five moments of the show.
Well, Ben, why don't you tell me your moment, and then we can go on a tangent.
For my first moment of the show, our second moment of the show, I'm going to point out how good Beaker was in this Muppet Labs segment. Because not only does he do his first, so far in terms of watch order, recorded meep, not only does he go off on a long complaining me bit that is, again, perfectly in keeping with his persona that is going to be established, but he's also doing bits. When Bunsen says a powerful microscope, he looks dead on to camera and then points at it. When, as Bunsen obviously is going to do, is saying that that powerful microscope is no longer useful, he then chucks the microscope behind him.
The German larger makes the microscope obsolete. Comes out of your pay, Beaker.
But against all logic, is then surprised when the microscope... The scientific assistant Beaker is surprised by gravity and then is instantly shocked at the ramifications, both financial and physical, that this has brought about.
Yeah.
And it's a series of good bits in keeping with what we love about the character in the future. This is a great germ of where the performers got locked in.
Well, I mean, this sketch was about a germ enlarger, so they just enlarged that germ of an idea.
Yes, yes, yes.
For my second moment, our third moment, the middle moment, as we like to say, I'm going to bring up something that you brought up earlier, which is in the UK spot, when Kermit blows out the candle.
Mm.
And the think about that, folks. That moment is perfect, as you said earlier. And I can't not, even though we discussed it at length, we can stop talking about it right now, but it needs to be a moment, because it is a good moment.
For my second moment, our fourth moment, the penultimate moment, I'd like to talk about the show's ultimate moment.
Mm.
I thought the final James Fenimore Cooper gag was brilliant. I literally cackled at how dumb good that joke was. I think in part it's because of Waldorf's two-camera delivery, but also I think it's the perfect cap on the gender play of the names. My sister James Fenimore Cooper is both obscure and teetering on the edge of brilliance, and I loved everything about it.
For my third moment, the fifth moment, our final moment, I would like to talk about Somewhere Over the Rainbow. And just mention how, as you brought up earlier, it was probably a dry run for the movie, but it is really a beautiful segment. The reflection of Robin in the reflecting pool, the usage of the rainbows as the special effects, it really is in a very weird, spooky episode, just a hint of something nice that Fozzie requested. And it is exactly what he wanted. It's nice, it's not boring. And like I said when you were bringing up the TV Guide thing, like, I feel like this should have been mentioned.
It's a showstopper of enough of a moment that it deserved recognition and pre-adulation.
Yeah.
I think, unfortunately, it's so not in keeping with the rest of the episode.
Which is why it was removed from the...
But also, I think they wouldn't have known how good it was. Like... Mm-hmm. When you're writing the TV Guide episode, I don't think you have a chance to preview the episode itself.
It's true.
And so I don't think they would have known just how good it was in order to say, you need to see this. But that's what it is. It's a moment that you needed to tune in to catch.
Mm-hmm. And publicizing it would have gotten more eyes. Because again, I do bet I'm right for my wild speculation of the episode.
Yeah.
People might not have watched this episode because they think Alice Cooper is satanic, and so I'm not going to let my kids watch this one. Where if they said, you're going to watch this thing from The Wiz, Earth of Oz, it would have gotten people to tune in.
Yeah, unless they tuned in during those 3 seconds of dead air, and then they would have been like, I don't know what's
ooh,
going
dead
on.
Air, that's too spooky.
That's right.
This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cones, Yes, We Have No Bananas. Under what we hope is transformative fair use, what does the Henson say when they first broadcast to Salmon Friends?
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Blue Sky at Farst Name Basis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in the podcast are used for the purposes of review. If there are ghoulies, ghosties, things that go bump in the night, facts, names, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on farstperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is... Ben.
This is the voice of doom!
And we'll see you next time when we discuss Season 3, Production Episode 24, guest starring Cheryl Ladd. Yay!